Welcome to A Contra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Contra AI. Today we're diving deep into a truly monumental work of French literature, Émile Zola's Germinal. It's fierce, unforgettable, and really defined the naturalist movement.
It absolutely did. And Zola himself, well, he wasn't just writing stories. He saw the novelist as a kind of social scientist, wouldn't you say?
Exactly. He had this core idea, this philosophy, that human lives weren't just about free will. He believed they were shaped, maybe even determined, by forces like heredity, environment,
and social circumstances. Those were his big three. He felt the writer's job was almost to run an experiment, or at least document the results of that experiment objectively.
And Germinal, which came out in 1885, feels like his most powerful case study for that theory. It's part of that huge Rougon-Macquart cycle, number 13, actually.
Right, the cycle tracing one family through the Second French Empire. And Germinal throws us right into the heart of the Industrial Revolution, the rise of factories, mines, and this huge, often impoverished working class.
The title itself, Germinal, is key, isn't it? It's from the old French Revolutionary calendar.
Yes, corresponding to springtime, March, April, the time of germination, of seeds sprouting. So Zola's asking right from the title, what's growing here in the darkness of the mines? What future is germinating from all this suffering?
It's a powerful question. And his method for answering it was, well, intense. He didn't just imagine it.
No, not at all. He spent months living with miners in northern France. He went down into the pits, talked to families, saw the poverty firsthand. That immersive research is why the book feels so raw, so authentic.
So let's go there to this fictional mining town, Montsou, in the 1860s. Mm-hmm. How does the story actually begin?
It starts bleakly. A cold, dark night. And this young man, Étienne Lantier, arrives. He's a mechanic, out of work, completely broke, just desperate for a job. He's an outsider.
And through his eyes, we immediately meet the real antagonist, you could say. Not a person, but the mine itself. Le Voreux.
Ah, Le Voreux. Zola describes it immediately, not just as a place, but as this monstrous entity, a voracious beast swallowing people whole.
It's an incredible metaphor right at the start. It tells you this isn't just about hard work. It's about a system that consumes people.
Exactly. And Étienne falls in with the Mahieu family. They become his entry point into the miners' world. Their life is this constant struggle against the mine itself, the danger, the dark, the collapses.
And against the company, the economic pressure,
yeah.
Low wages, debt, this faceless corporation controlling their lives.
It's already a pressure cooker situation. And then Zola adds the trigger. The company decides to change the payment system. Effectively, a wage cut they just can't afford.
And Étienne, being new, maybe a bit more educated, having read some socialist ideas, he arrives at just the right, or maybe wrong, moment. He becomes both a witness and, well, a catalyst.
He really does. He starts to articulate the miners' anger, to organize them.
Before we follow the strike itself, let's talk about the people. Étienne is central, of course, but he's not just an idealistic leader. He's got this darkness inside him, doesn't he?
Yes, the Macquart flaw. That hereditary tendency towards sudden, violent rage that runs through his family line and Zola's cycle. It's a constant battle for him.
So Zola uses him to explore that tension, the desire for progress, for socialist ideals, clashing with this inherited, almost deterministic violence. It's like he's asking if you can ever truly escape your background.
Right. And Zola has this brutal line somewhere about education making men unfit for manual labor and manual labor making them unfit for thought. Étienne feels trapped in that paradox. He knows too much to accept the mine, but his roots maybe hold him back from fully escaping.
And then there's Catherine Mahieu. If Étienne represents the struggle with heredity, Catherine embodies the crushing weight of the environment, particularly for women.
Oh, absolutely. She faces what you call double oppression. The mine crushes her spirit, and she's dominated by this brutish miner, Cheval. He's possessive, cruel.
Her story is heartbreaking. Caught between Cheval, who basically claims her, and this unspoken feeling for Étienne, she has so little agency.
And her parents, Toussaint Mahieu and La Mahoud, show the shift in the older generation. Toussaint starts off resigned, practical, knowing a strike means starvation.
But he finds his dignity in resisting eventually.
Yes. And La Mahoud's transformation is maybe even more dramatic. She starts as this incredibly practical mother, just focused on feeding her children. But as hunger takes hold,
she becomes this embodiment of pure righteous fury, the protective mother bear turned avenger.
Her grief and anger are terrifyingly powerful.
Now, Étienne brings socialist ideals, but Zola doesn't just present one viewpoint. There are counter-arguments within the miner circle, aren't there? Like Souvarine.
Ah, Souvarine, the Russian anarchist. He's completely different. Cold, detached. He thinks Etienne's organized socialism is pointless, just replacing one system with another.
What's his solution, then?
Total annihilation. Destruction. He has this chilling line. There are no longer any just or unjust causes. There is only force against force. For him, the only answer is to destroy the machine entirely. No compromise. Just oblivion.
So you have Etienne's idealism, Souvarine's nihilism, and then you have the other side, the bourgeoisie, the mine owners and managers. How does Zola portray them? Are they just mustache-twirling villains?
It's more nuanced, but ultimately damning. You have the Grégoire family, who own shares in the mine. They practice this kind of smug, paternalistic charity. They feel benevolent, but they live comfortably off the miner's suffering.
Oblivious or willfully ignorant.
And then there's Enobo, the manager. He's actually quite miserable himself, caught between the shareholders demanding profits and the workers demanding survival. Zola shows how the system dehumanizes everyone, even though seemingly in charge, but the hypocrisy is thick.
That detail you mentioned earlier is so sharp. The bourgeois talking about the dignity of labor and their salons.
But none would dream of letting their daughter marry a miner. It just exposes the chasm between their words and their reality.
Okay, so the strike begins. How does Zola structure this descent into chaos? You mentioned the seven parts mirror germination.
Right. Parts one to third are the seeds being sown. Etienne settles in, ideas spread, the wage cut happens, and they vote to strike. There's this initial hope, solidarity.
But then comes part four, the struggle and hunger.
Hunger is the turning point. Zola shows how it doesn't just strengthen resolve, it twists it. Hope curdles into desperation, then into rage. It becomes less controlled, more primal.
And that leads into the violent climax in part five.
Mm.
The strike breaks down into mob violence.
It's terrifying. The miners march from pit to pit, enforcing the strike, destroying property. Zola doesn't romanticize it at all. He shows the ugly side of the crowd. And the absolute low point is the incident with McGrath, the shopkeeper.
The one who exploited the miners' wives.
Yes. He's killed by the mob, and his body is horribly mutilated. It's a moment of pure animalistic vengeance. And for Etienne, it's horrifying. He sees this force he's unleashed but cannot control, a violence that mirrors his own internal struggle.
That moment really feels like the moral point of no return for the collective action.
It does. And it seals their fate. The authorities have their justification. Part six is the defeat. The military arrives.
And they fire on the unarmed miners. Dusamahu is killed. The strike is utterly broken.
Crushed. And for Souvarine, the anarchist, this is just proof that gradual change, organized strikes, they're all futile. So he takes matters into his own hands.
He acts on his philosophy.
He secretly sabotages the mine, Lavoureux, weakens the timbering, damages the drainage pumps. He sets the stage for the final catastrophe.
Which unfolds underground in part seven. The mine floods and collapses.
Exactly. Etienne, Catherine, and her abuser, Cheval, are trapped together in the darkness as the water rises. It's the ultimate nightmare scenario.
And in that desperate, claustrophobic end, Etienne finally snaps.
He gives in to that McCourt rage and kills Cheval. The ideological struggles, the strike, it all boils down to this primal fight in the dark.
And then what happens between him and Catherine?
Facing death, they finally confess their love for each other. They have a brief, tragic moment of intimacy before Catherine succumbs to the cold and exhaustion, dying in his arms.
It's almost unbearably tragic. Etienne is eventually rescued miraculously after days underground. But what's left? The strike failed. The people are dead or broken. Where's the germination the title promised?
That's the brilliance of the ending. On the surface, it's total defeat. All the ideologies failed, didn't they? Rassner's moderate reformism didn't work. Etienne's socialist idealism led to disaster. Souvarine's nihilistic destruction just caused more death.
System won in the short term.
Yes. But Zola lifts our gaze. The ending isn't just about the immediate failure. Remember all that sensory detail, the darkness, the crushing pressure, the hunger. It wasn't just for realism. It shows the necessity of the struggle, the unbearable conditions that had to provoke a reaction.
So the hope isn't in the outcome of this strike.
Not entirely. The final scene, Etienne is leaving Montsou. It's a spring morning, the sun is out, and he walks through the fields and he feels something. He senses the future stirring beneath the ground.
That's where the famous final lines come in, right?
Exactly. Men were springing forth, a black avenging army germinating slowly in the furrows, growing towards the harvests of the next century. It reframes the entire story.
The defeat becomes fertilizer.
Precisely. The blood and suffering weren't in vain, Zola suggests. They are the seeds of future uprisings, future demands for justice. The germination is slow, hidden, but inevitable.
So Germinal transforms this specific, brutal labor dispute into something more mythic, a story about the enduring human fight for dignity, even when immediate victory seems impossible.
It forces you to confront that hard truth. Sometimes future justice grows from the tragedies of the present. It's a bleak outlook in some ways, but also strangely hopeful in the long run.
A relentless, analytical, yet deeply human book. It shows how tied we are to our circumstances, but also suggests that the collective struggle, even a failure, plants the seeds for change.
Absolutely. A harrowing but essential read.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.